Hey everyone, welcome to Rogue Signal, the weekly games podcast for Rogue.Slight. I think we're at episode 10 here. We're a cool website about video games, and this is a cool podcast that goes with it. I'm one of your hosts, and one of the co-founders of Rogue, Ryan Gilliam. With me are my fellow co-hosts and fellow co-founders, Jeffrey Parkin.
Hello.
And Cass Marshall.
Hey, hello.
We're all sicky this week, or varying degrees of it. We got migraines, we got sinuses, we got all sorts of fun cold stuff going into the winter months here. So please bear with us. It's usually, this is where I say it's been 2 weeks since we last all chatted, but that's only partially true. Last week we had a bonus episode go up for my trip to see Destiny 2 Renegades, which we'll talk a little bit about today here. And then we also are going to talk a little bit about Game of the Year, what we're going to be doing here at Rogue, and before moving into some new games we've been playing, some updates to some old games that are very good, and some other stuff like that. So first we're going to dive in here on my trip. So in early November, I went to Bellevue, Washington, which is where Bungie's headquarters are located, to see Destiny 2 Renegades. If you're unfamiliar, Renegades is unique in terms of Destiny expansions because it's the first time that Bungie's ever done a crossover thing, because they are using the Star Wars license with this expansion. So it's a Star Wars Destiny crossover and all the weird stuff that comes with that. But notably, it's not like Destiny in the Star Wars canon or Star Wars in the Destiny canon. It's like a Star Wars story. Or it's a Destiny story that has Star Wars like themes and stuff around it, but to such a degree that they have to have a license for it. However, there is no like Darth Vader or Han Solo. Even the lightsaber equivalent is not called a lightsaber. So it's doing weird stuff. And I went there and spent like 2 days checking it out. There's a lot of content on the site about my experience with this. I put a pretty long preview on the site. I did the bonus episode that I mentioned before with some of my own Destiny friends who asked me a bunch of Destiny questions about it. And then I did an interview with Robbie Stevens, who's the assistant game director and also kind of the face of the game at the moment, and Allison Lures, who's the narrative designer. It was a pretty interesting one. Because as you can imagine, there are a lot of interesting and weird questions about like, what does all of this mean for like the future of Destiny? It's really weird. By the time that this comes out, it'll be out. But like, I'm really excited about it. It's really fresh and new. I'm a Star Wars fan, but I also kind of anticipated that this could suck pretty badly if done badly. And like, Star Wars has not exactly been great outside of like Andor in the recent years. So, and Destiny's had a hard 6 months. So it was a real like weird feeling going into this thing. But you can go check out all my thoughts on it. Yeah, Jeff, please ask me a question.
No, yes, go read Brian's stuff. I read all of it. It's super good. Can you talk about like, the danger in doing something like that is that it comes off as super forced and just
forced, you say? Forced?
Forced or like Fortnite-ified? Like,
yes.
How well did they avoid that?
Yes. Please, everyone, like as the non-Destiny players here, like please, any and all questions that you have about this thing. It's really weird. So I'm happy to chat about it. I am very curious what the non-Destiny gamers out there want to know about it. Because this definitely is like a play to bring non-Destiny people into Destiny. So I think there are two answers to this question. The Fortniteification of Destiny happened a long time ago. And it's fair. Part of the reason a lot of people were really kind of trepidatious about this thing when they announced it, because like since around Witch Queen or Beyond Light, one of those two, around after Bungie got like their independence and started doing stuff, I want to say they started working with people like Epic, and they were like, the first time they ever did like crossover skins was for like some literal Fortnite, like Black Knight stuff that I don't recognize because I don't really play much Fortnite. And then they did like, there's been Witcher crossovers, and like now since doing Sony stuff, they've had like Kratos armor that I use quite a bit. And there's like Mass Effect crossover stuff in there that's like cosmetic only armor. It's only cosmetic. And in, they've done a Star Wars one before this, I assume probably when this was in development, that I really did not like because it's literally just like Stormtrooper armor. And so they've done this kind of shit before where like when the Witcher thing came in, they were like, it's not like the Eververse armor is annoying and it is what it is. But like they also had stuff where it's like, ooh, you can see the Witcher's pool in this other character's little corner of their like hideout. And that really like took me out of it. I really hated it. It made this like really big universe that I care a lot about feel super small and icky, and I didn't like it. And I still don't really like watching like a literal Stormtrooper, or now at this point, like literal Kylo Ren or literal General Grievous or literal Darth Vader, like people in full-on cosplay walking around the tower. Like, I hate that. I think it sucks. So that's been in there for a while. And was part of the pre-order, like the Darth Vader stuff was part of the pre-order for this expansion, which just did not bode well. And in talking to people there when I went to see Edge of Fate in May, they were like, I think maybe that sold the wrong message. Because Renegades is different. There is no Han Solo. There is no Darth Vader. Instead, you have characters like Drifter, who has always been roguish, playing the role, or filling the role in the story that Han Solo would. Or you have, like, a big Cabal Emperor dude filling the role of, like, a Darth Vader walking into a ship and taking a bunch of blaster fire and just completely shrugging it off like it's nothing. You have, like, a Kylo Ren stand-in that's very, very Kylo Ren-y, but is a character in the world of Destiny that is pulled from old lore that they haven't really talked about in a long time. Their, like, Jedi equivalent is, like, the very kind of cop-like order of guardians that, like, are very much internal affairs kind of executioners who are, like, very by the books, by the numbers, stick in the muds. And so, like, they have all these equivalents, but they pull from this old Destiny history. And so it feels great, actually. It was, like, the biggest thing that I was the most very curious about going in is, like, are they going to get this right? Is this going to feel cheap? Is it going to feel stupid? And, like, I think because they have the license, they can go farther with it than, like, Star Wars influences everything, especially sci-fi stuff. So, like, there's been Star Wars DNA in Destiny forever. There always has been, even before they started putting skins and stuff in there. And so this is a lot further than that because they have the license. But because they have the license, they can go over that line, but they do it in a thoughtful way that I think doesn't feel terrible.
So what does that look like?
Yeah.
Like, as someone who is, I guess, you mentioned this is, like, hopefully something to draw new players, like, my first reaction to, I guess, hearing about it was just, oh, no, thank you. Because I'm not a fan of crossovers. I'm not a fan of Fortnite. I don't even like that Helldivers has, like, a Halo war bond. I don't like that, you know, No Man's Sky has the Normandy. I think that's just a really irritating trend in design right now in general, is that everything is everything. Everything is Fortnite. Yes. I like things to retain their own sort of distinct identity. So if it was just a straight crossover, I would be, like, completely disinterested. But, like, what does something look like to be sort of a tasteful Star Wars homage yet still require the license? Like, are we getting a John Williams soundtrack? Is it, are people in carbonite? Like, what's going on there?
So, interesting answers to both of those, actually, which is that, like, the soundtrack is very good, but, and it's very Star Wars evocative. But, like, the sound effects are sometimes literally one-to-one because there's a new blaster type of weapon. And some of those blasters look a lot like Star Wars blasters, like specific ones. Like, you can get a hand cannon that looks very similar to, like, Andor's pistol or, like, One of the very cool ones is like a really hard hitting, uses a different ammo type than most hand cannons, which is usually a primary weapon, uses special ammo, so it's limited, but it's like Hans Blaster, and it looks a lot like Hans Blaster, and it sounds a lot like Hans Blaster. And a lot of those, like some of the sound effects are literally one-to-one, but the soundtrack is Bungie's people, as far as I can tell. Bungie's composers doing like an homage that feels very John Williams-y, that feels very like high fantasy sci-fi Star Wars-y, like very inspired by that feel. But like, so I think that the first mission is kind of like a really good encapsulation of what they're doing here that I think is effective. It is not the Normandy is in Destiny. I mean, the Normandy is in Destiny, but that's from a different crossover from another gross thing from forever ago. Instead, it's like you, Drifter, which is kind of this like outlaw character who's also a guardian, and then like is in a ship with some other characters who've long existed, who kind of fill the role of like a force witch, who also kind of is Princess Leia in the story, the cop, and then your alien companion who's, they said, they use like a Chewbacca comparison there, and I'm like, she's more C-3PO, for sure. But she's the bookish, nerdy alien. And basically, like, the premise is all within the world of Destiny. Like, Drifter has stolen a data disk, and you're being tracked by this, like, big, new, surprising faction from an existing faction in the game. Like, they're more technologically advanced for confusing reasons that they get into, which is actually really cool. And you get like sucked into their ship, and you like, they break through the door, and there's a bunch of blaster fire and smoke, and Drifter gets like taken, and you walk out of the hall, and there's like black, you know, reflective glass flooring, and standing on that are Cabal enemies in like white armor, which is a new look for them, but it's not stormtrooper armor. It's just evocative, seeing white imperial-looking soldiers standing against a black reflective backdrop.
So it's Star Wars with the serial numbers filed off.
Not exactly, because it still feels like Destiny in the fact that like it still feels part of the world, and part of that is part that is really well done from the narrative team, because they've started a new like saga, because they last year they ended like their 10-year story thing with the final shape, and then in the Edge of Fate, one of the few things that people really liked about it was this new story they were telling, and something that I think I certainly expected going into this was like, this is going to be a Star Wars side story, and then we'll get back to the story they started telling. But they do a really nice job of mixing in the new story with this, like, Star Wars theming. So, like, they wanted to from the beginning, like, no quotes, and they don't follow the beats exactly from, like, something like A New Hope. But A New Hope is kind of the structure with which they use to imagine this Destiny story. But it tells, like, I can't get too into it. I mean, I'm not technically... right now, we're recording this on Monday. I'm still under embargo, but by the time this comes out, the embargo will be out. But I don't want to spoil it for people either, so, because it'll just be a day out. But they do a really good job of, like, using... It's not Star Wars logic that explains why this empire is here. It's Destiny logic. It's Destiny characters. All that, they just fit into roles. There are heavy homages, like... Something that I think is probably on the nose for too many people is, like, there's a trash compactor on the ship. But... at the same time, they've done that reference before on another ship of the same faction. And so there's precedent in the world of Destiny that these Cabal ships have these trash compactors that you go through. And so they've done that before. They've done the legwork, ironically, with old Star Wars references to be able to bring that back around. So it doesn't feel too bad. The Drifter does get encased in ice. And so you escort him out of it so it's like it's playing the carbonite role. But it is kind of that like... it's the kind of thing that as I was playing it, I was smiling at, because it is like, it's beyond on the nose. And it's obvious. They're calling it what it is. They're saying it's Star Wars inspired, but it's not so one-to-one that it lacks surprise, that it feels like it's entirely hokey. So it kind of like is this, because it's unique, it's hard to describe. And it's the kind of thing that like, even as I was writing my preview, I was like, this is something that if I were to just read this, I'd be like, this probably sucks. But it doesn't. It's really actually well done and well balanced. And that seemed to be the general consensus of people that I was there with. And it, like, yes, they have lightsabers, but the lightsabers are like part of, are mentioned. They're not described as lightsabers in the old lore, but like Praxic Blades, which is what it's called in Destiny, has like lore precedent. Like this order has, like I was listening to a video today of someone talking about there being a mention of Praxic Blades in these old lore books. Now, is that a literal meaning? Do they literally mean a sword in that book? Maybe not. But like, they do a really, the narrative team especially does a really deft job of justifying everything in a way that feels good and interesting, and which allows, I think, the art and sound team to just kind of go full Star Wars with it. And the result is something that I think feels really weirdly fresh in Destiny, in this world that has felt like, even though it's been inspired by Star Wars and a lot of Star, like, sci-fi things before, and it wears those pretty blatantly and always has. Running it feels like weirdly fresh in a way.
Jeff, it almost sounds like the Tales of the Jedi cartoons that are all bringing in various animators with various styles to tell a Star Wars story. And it almost feels like we're using.
I think that's. Are you talking about the anime thing?
Yeah,
I think Tales of the Jedi is a different show, like in the Clone Wars canon.
Am I saying you're talking about
Visions? Star Wars Visions, I think.
Yes. I think you're talking about Visions. I'm sorry. Yes.
Yeah.
It sounds
that's
like
an interesting
Visions.
Comparison. That's a pretty interesting comparison point, because like it both functions as like what if Bungie made a Star Wars, while also functioning as like what if Destiny was even more, was like what if Bungie could do whatever they wanted without being worried about being sued in terms of like what they wanted to pull from Star Wars. But it's not like the canons are mixing. Like there is nothing in Star Wars. Like there's nothing. They're not like trying to jump through hoops to make Star Wars canon in Destiny or anything like that. There is no mention or anything like that. It is just ideas and art from that world pulled into an existing one that feels interesting. I'm curious if there's going to be any kind of meta commentary to it, because Bungie's done stuff like that before, in terms of like, one of the more crafty characters has had some like weird, it's a game kind of meta stuff in lore books in the past. And the big bads that we're dealing with right now are like, other planar, like unknowable deities that have been in the lore for like 11 years that we're just now expanding on. So they could also very easily be like, this place is as like taken inspiration from some art in. I hope they don't do that, and I don't think they're going to do that. It feels pretty careful. They were very explicit about, like, when I talked to them about being like, we didn't want to do quotes. We tried it. It sucks. It takes you out of it immediately. It's bad. I talked to them a little bit about like what they tried that didn't work. They said that like the first thing that they did, when they sat down with Lucasfilm Games, was like, Allison Lurs, the narrative director, passed out sticky notes to everybody, like as an icebreaker, to be like, okay, everyone write down the worst version of this. Like, what happens if this, like, if this sucked shit, what does it look like? And everyone wrote some stuff down, and that's like where they talked about it. Like, so they have been cognizant from the beginning that, like, this could go real bad. And to be clear, I've only played, you know, maybe 40 to 50% of the story content in here. But they're threading that needle, and they're doing it pretty well so far. I will be curious to see where that lands, and I'll be curious to see how the dismount is, because like it's going to be interesting to move in April to their next update that is like a continuation, but they don't have the license for that. So it'll be like, how does Bungie transition away from something like this again? And do they ever do it again? Currently, the answer to that question is no. They don't have anything else in the works. But like, I've never quite seen a studio, in terms of like what I can tell, try something like this. It's usually the Fortnite thing and the crossover, which again, Bungie has done and I don't like. But this, so far, I like, and I'm like very excited to jump in with my friends and play some tomorrow and then write about it in December.
Yeah, it's interesting because, so I don't play Destiny. I have not played Destiny. And part of that is, to me, Destiny just has a really hard time selling itself to me. You know, if I want to learn about the lore, people are like, you gotta check this guy out. And it's like, explaining Destiny lore, a 6-hour video. And I'm like, oh my God, I would rather flee into the woods and eat berries for the rest of my life than have to sit through that homework assignment. Like, yep. You know. Which is not an insult to Destiny itself. It's just the nature of a live service game is that, you know, content comes, content goes. New players are always playing catch up and sort of figuring out exactly what, you know, the golden age of the game was. And I guess what is interesting to me, and it is not the direction I personally would have gone, is that Star Wars started as like being inspired by serial adventures. And over time, Star Wars has just kind of become a genre unto itself, where instead of referencing those serial adventures, it's referencing Star Wars. And obviously, Andor is considered to be great. I enjoy bits of The Last Jedi. I really enjoy Star Wars The Old Republic, the MMO by EA that is still going, despite not being a WoW killer as was once hoped or planned. And
that game's great.
It is. I'm curious about Outlaws. So I'm definitely like fine with Star Wars to a degree. But to me, it's like, if I were like, what is something sort of like a bold vision of storytelling for new players? For me, I would worry that Star Wars is pretty rote at this point. Like, Star Wars is an aesthetic. And I think part of this is the movies have blundered it so badly, where somehow Palpatine returned in Fortnite. And it's just, you know, like referencing the past movies without having anything to say in and of itself, that I personally don't have the hunger to be like, oh, I can't wait to see another Star Wars story. How are they going to interpret the core theme of Star Wars? Because, like, goodness, we've gotten cartoons, movies, many books, 3 distinct time periods between the Old Republic, High Republic, and modern setting. So, you know, not to disparage it at all, especially because I haven't played it. It's just, to me, a curious choice. And I guess I'm just wondering, like, is the Star Wars license and the dream of Star Wars so powerful and potent that, despite my skepticism, other people are like, hell yeah, dude, let's check this shit out. Probably. I imagine that's the case for some people.
Maybe. That's the question I have for you as well, is like, is this going to be enough to bring people into the game? I kind of don't think so. I think Bungie is like a real, I'm also not really seeing the marketing, because now I'm not the demographic for that also. So I'm like, I'm not really seeing the marketing for it. I'm curious what the method is there. And I'm curious if that was the original plan. And then it kind of went sideways when Edge of Fate came out and broke the game in a way that people really hated. And they've spent the past 6 months fixing it instead of, which makes it a lot harder to jump in. But I think the selling point is interesting because, yeah, I mean, like I'm an original trilogy fan. I think I'm a J.J. Abrams sequel hater and a Rian Johnson defender. So, like, I like The Last Jedi a lot. I think there's some messy parts in it. I think the Luke storyline is great. Get at me. People are captured by fear as they age. That's the storyline. That's very human. Fuck off. Read a book. Sorry. But like, and I have increasingly grown fond of some of the things, especially the geopolitical stuff that Lucas talks about in the prequels, I think is fascinating and well done, actually. So like, I like Star Wars a lot. I've watched all of the Clone Wars, but it has lost its magic for me, certainly in the years. And I think like Rise of Skywalker is might genuinely be one of the worst movies I've ever seen in my life, and killed like a lot of joy for the franchise for me. And I think for a lot of people, it's just beyond rotten. And I don't think Star Wars is in like an amazing place right now, personally. And especially with like, I mean, Boba Fett felt very like sloppish. A lot of stuff with like the Mandalorian like fell off after people were super interested in it. I liked Obi-Wan fine, but I haven't still, like, I was a big fan. I was like, not seen Ahsoka yet. I like that character a lot. So it's just not, Star Wars is not in a place that it really is capturing the core demographic that it used to. The Acolyte, you know, flopped badly.
Star Wars has also had ups and downs. Like,
right.
I think we all remember the era of Star Wars where there was like the Kinect game with Han Solo dancing.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, like, before Nerd Dubai was built with Galaxy's Edge and everything, you would have like Darth Vader just shuffling out at Disneyland for like dance battles and stuff. It was all very like silly. Journey to Batuu, the Sims 4 tie-in, is considered one of the worst because it's not even like, you can't even kiss Kylo Ren and marry Kylo Ren. Kylo Ren is stuck in Batuu. You can go and look at him and interact with him in Disney-approved ways, which is not good or fun, right? But then you have stuff like, I have heard pretty good stuff about Outlaws. Like, no one's like, oh, it's game of the year. It's a transcendent experience that will, like, you know, it is a fun Star Wars role.
It is fun.
Right? Mm-hmm. So, like, even Star Wars itself is super variable. Like, as a franchise, it has had its ups and its downs. Mostly its downs. But
yeah. But, like, the Jedi games are one of the better things to come out of the modern era of Star Wars, I think. And like one of the things that I'm, as the EA clock is ticking, with its recent investment, it's the thing like the final game in the Jedi trilogy is the one I'm the most like, we got to get this out, guys. We got to get this going before it gets fucked up. So like, but I think largely like Star Wars is in a less good place than it was, and Destiny is in a similar position. And so weirdly, like, this team up is effective at like increasing my affection for both. And in my time in playing it and like waiting for it, like, I ended up starting something else, but I was seriously considering looking into being like, oh, I should watch those last two Mando seasons that I haven't seen yet. And I should go actually visit Ahsoka. I really like that character. And I hadn't heard a lot of shit about the Acolyte, but I really should probably watch it at this point. Like, I was like thinking of ruminating. I was like ruminating on going back to these things. And like, I spent a lot of time getting ready for this expansion in Destiny. Like, I'm looking forward to it in a way that, like, when I heard about this, when I thought about all the other stuff that Bungie has done and the Fortnite-ification shit and the way that I hate it, and the way that I feel about Star Wars, I was just like not excited. But instead, I think the sales pitch that they should really be going with more is like, it's less like, isn't this a fun Star Wars story? And it's more like, Destiny stories are in a really interesting place right now. Follow this new story, but you can shoot people with blasters that sound like they're from Star Wars, and the gunplay is better than the gunplay in any other Star Wars shooting game, because that's what Bungie does. It's like, would you like to see how Bungie could make Han Solo's blaster feel, and would you also like to hear a cool Destiny story while you're at it that's like doesn't require that much background knowledge in terms of like what's going on compared to how things have been in the last 10 years? Because, like, yeah, that the 2024, My Name is Bife, who's like the big lore guy, met him at the event. Very sweet guy. Great dude. Yeah, he put out a 10-hour video in 2024 before the final shape, before the conclusion. So it's not even the full story at this point, because more stuff happened after that. And, like, yeah, getting in there is crazy, but, like, what if you could jump in with very little overhead on and understanding the bits of the story and get some fun Star Wars blaster stuff going on with it? It's going to be interesting to see how it does, but I think I was very surprised by how effectively they hit that promise. We'll have to see how they end it, and we'll have to see if, like, the Star Wars of it all gets old. But when the references were coming, I found that they were few and far enough between that they made me smile instead of made me be like, fucking come on. Where's the destiny in this? That I didn't have that experience. So I'm curious to see what people think about it.
I think this is going to be what finally gets me to try Destiny again.
I got you a PC code this time, so we can now try. You don't have to worry about your weird PlayStation problems.
Yeah,
like last time. I cannot wait to see what you think about at least that first mission.
Yeah, I'm enough of a Star Wars fan that I think this could pull me back into Destiny. Also, you have to watch The Acolyte. The Acolyte was great. Don't listen to.
Yeah, it's like the Deep Space Nine of Star Wars, which I know I'm going to get a lot of hate for that. But it's the type of thing that, like, some people are like, well, a lot of people are like, Deep Space Nine doesn't feel like Star Trek because they're stuck on a space station all the time. And other people will be like, Deep Space Nine is the best Star Trek has ever been, and you're never going to capture it again. I have heard in that way, in the divisiveness of it, I have heard people be like, The Acolyte is such a cool look into the Old Republic and, like, be before the Old Republic and, like, the super early timeline of Jedi stuff. It's really neat. What a cool experiment. I really like what they're doing. And then a lot of people who are like, cry my canon, oh my God, they're ruining it, it's everything, and also maybe it's woke. So, which is never a criticism to be taken seriously anyway. One of the easier ways to get me to watch something is if a shitty person calls it woke.
Exactly.
I want to try it out. I certainly, from the people that I have heard, the thing about it that gives me pause is that I've heard people who, like, Star Wars fans I know cry about it, but I have also heard some people say, like, they just don't think it's a very well-made television show, which is the thing that I think might ruin it.
What I would say is that The Acolyte, to me, was kind of aggressively mid, where it had some very cool ideas, a great antagonist. There was just also stuff where I'm like, that needed another draft. Like, it wasn't ever offensively bad. I was never like, ugh.
Sounds like a Disney Plus show.
Yeah, I was like, this needs a little bit more time in the oven. And they used to be able to have that. Shows used to be able to cook a little bit. You know what I mean? Like,
only for Tony Gilroy, I guess.
Yeah, I thought season one Acolyte was kind of mid, right? But, like, I was like, you know, Deep Space Nine, season one had some incredibly bad episodes or some mid episodes. Like, you used to just have...
TNG has some very bad episodes in those first two seasons.
Oh, yeah.
And like, I love it with all my heart.
Episodes, and, like, sometimes the episode is like, the Enterprise must tackle first contact with a super intelligent plague. You know, I'm like, oh, hell yeah. And sometimes it's like, Beverly fucks a ghost. And I'm like, hell yeah,
oh my God,
go.
That episode, yeah, the same show contains Beverly fucks a ghost, and let's discuss the value of sentience of what it means to be human.
Yeah,
like, right. Yeah. So The Acolyte was just trapped in prestige hell, where like, huge budget demands huge returns, but also it's a super experimental piece. And I'm like, this was just it has been incredibly frustrating watching Disney handle Star Wars.
Yeah.
And I do think a big part of that is Star Wars was set up to be a funnel to what I had jokingly called Nerd Dubai earlier. You were supposed to go to Galaxy's Edge. You were supposed to sign up for the Star Cruiser experience. Jenny Nicholson did a phenomenal, like, 6-hour
video
on the whole experience.
So good.
As somebody who wanted to go to that at one point in my life, that video is so good.
Like, when they bought Star Wars, it really felt like Disney was like, the movies don't really fucking matter, guys. We'll put them out. There'll be lightsabers. People will go, hooray, and then buy tickets. And then, one, COVID happened. too, the culture war happened, and you is how like I dare not go into a crowded space and go, that was a pretty good movie, because I'll hear like thump, 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 someone running up behind me to go, but Jedi can't be plural. That's woke. And I'm like, oh God. On the flip side, I also can't be like, I thought the B plot was pretty messy. And I think like Rian Johnson did Finn dirty as a character. Cause then someone will be like, you fucking idiot. The Last Jedi is a brilliant masterpiece that outshines anything else in the canon. And I'm like, this sucks. I don't like any part of this.
Canto we've lost is nuance. Embarrassing.
Oh, it's embarrassingly bad. Yeah, we've lost any sense of nuance because you can't jump into the idea about being. It's like trying to be like Captain Marvel is not a good Marvel movie because it's badly written and badly directed, and then people are like, "Yeah, fuck Allison Brie," and you're like, "No, no, no, hold on,
didn't say
I'm
that.
Not on your I'm team. Not on your side, buddy.
No, no, we think the movie is bad for different reasons. It's the same thing about being like." I don't think Daisy Ridley or John Boyega are that great of performers in those movies, especially when compared to like people who I think are better in those movies as actors dealing with similarly bad material.
I know, but they did not... Finn so dirty though that I'm giving Boyega a bit of a pass. Like
exactly.
Even in The Last Jedi, when it opens with Finn like sloshing out and he has all the medical stuff on him and it's clearly put, I went, oh no. Like in my chair, I was like, oof. Not as bad as The Rise of Skywalker. And I think the funniest part of The Rise of Skywalker is not the movie itself, but sort of the press war between Abrams and Disney. Like the best comparison I can come up with to seeing all like the trades being like, actually, J.J. Abrams is the guy who came up with the little, like, you know, puppet everyone liked. And Disney said they didn't like it, but J.J. Abrams fought for it. Actually, Disney wanted this, and J.J. Abrams, like, you know what I mean, the back and forth. It's like you go to a restaurant, and you order a meal, and the meal sucks. And the waiter comes out, he gives you a big plate of whipped cream, and then he goes, I really want to give you an actual meal, but the kitchen said you have to eat the whipped cream. And then, like, you're like, I don't know, man. Can I just get a meal? And he's like, I really can't. Then the manager comes out and he's like, the whipped cream is actually great, but you got bad whipped cream because the cook is mad. And I'm like, just give me the fucking meal. I don't need, like, the back and forth between the director and the, like, there was just so much blame going around. And I'm like, everyone should feel bad. I don't know. Why are you involving
me in
this?
It's even just J.J. Abrams against Rian Johnson. I've never seen a movie that is so, where one director is so like directly fighting the person who made the movie before it. It's like if James Cameron came out and like made Aliens to spite Ridley Scott, like is what the whole movie feels like, where Luke comes on basically is like, oh, my entire motivation has changed because chuds were mad on the internet, is like the movie. And it's terrible. We need more nuance. We need to be able to discuss that Destiny and Star Wars can mix together in ways that aren't just Destiny Star Wars. And we need to be able to discuss that Allison Brie can be good and Captain Marvel can be bad as a movie without it being an indictment on her or her politics. Or similarly, we should be able to say that like Finn was done dirty and also John Boyega lacks charisma in those movies. We can exist in multiple realities where multiple things are true, and we need better internet nuance just as a whole. Stay tuned for our Star Wars podcast.
Yeah, whereas I don't like Destiny simply because I've dedicated myself to the other big online robot gun guy game, which is Warframe. And I don't have enough room in my life for two online robot gun guy games in space. Are you kidding me? Like, that's just too
much. I have avoided Warframe because Warframe seems like too much just on its own.
It's a lot. It's fun.
I mean,
the funny thing about Warframe is it's the only live service game that, this is true, that Destiny fans can legally make fun of. They're
that's
the only
fair.
Ones. Yeah.
Yeah, but I'm just going to say that Warframe has a union. Like, there's a whole planet where there's a union full of workers and like they have a cool song that goes along with it. And then you kill capitalists on your fucking hoverboard. And then you go to the 90s to hang out with a mall with a bunch of hot people and do a dating sim. Does Destiny have a dating sim?
That does sound cool. We had a fishing mini game, but they took it out. Does that count? Man, is that anything?
There's a fishing mini game. Warframe is great because have you ever seen a Kickstarter that's like, this is an MMORPG I'm making that has a fishing game, a fighting mini game, PvE, PvP, gems, crafting, snowboarding, animal husbandry. Like, it goes on
and
on.
It's called Destiny Rising, and it's real messy right now.
You're like, bullshit. You didn't make that game, but that game does exist. And it's Warframe. Warframe has fucking everything. You'll play for 50 hours and you'll get a new character creation unlock and you'll like it.
It also turns out...
What is going on in Warframe?
Yeah, based on listening to that, turns out I don't know what Warframe is.
Nobody knows what Warframe is. They're just like, that's the game where you're a robot gun guy, right? And I'm like,
yeah,
that's close enough that I'm just going to agree with you. But, oh boy, it's so much more.
You sweet summer child.
I had no idea.
That game's also getting a big expansion this month, right?
Yes. So basically, Warframe has what I would call two separate types of content drops. The first is your regular online sandbox stuff, like a new mission type, like a campaign where it's like, oh, you know, everyone's trying to raise community supplies towards this like outcome. You know, in the summer, they'll do a pool party mode where everyone's playing with pool noodles and has like the floaty rings on. Just like
how
live
do you
game
say-
stuff.
You say two completely normal things, and then you say an insane thing.
I don't know. I feel like a lot of games
Destiny
have like holiday modes now. So
okay.
Yep.
But
that's normal, Jeff. Every MMO has a winter thing. In every Christmas, people bake Commander Zavala thousands of cookies in Destiny 2. And presumably, he's like very diabetic at this point. And
I think some data showed people like seasonal events. So now every single game, you'll log into like medieval combat MMO, and it'll be like, it's Christmas time. Go send your soldiers caroling. I don't know. It's just a thing in the industry that we all have to deal with.
We've replaced all of our swords with wrapping paper tubes.
Yeah, isn't candy canes? Isn't that fun? but yeah, so Warframe will have the stuff that's just like, here's some gameplay. And then they release narrative chapters. And so the old piece is a massive narrative chapter that builds off, you know, all of the crazy lore that I've talked about. Like, Jeff, if I were to show you the trailer for the old piece, it would be like giving a Dorito to a medieval peasant. You would not know what is going on. You would be unable to handle any of it, right? But if you're a Warframe fan, you're watching it and you're just like, oh my God, what an epic gamer moment this is shaping up to be. There is an alternative to Warframe from Digital Extremes, which is they are working on a game now that just opened up to a larger public audience. It is called Soulframe. And as you might guess from the frame term, it's very similar in structure, in you know, player access and payment and gameplay, but it's much more of like an Elden Ring fantasy setting. It's much slower paced. Like, I think one of the defining features of Warframe, or even people who don't even know anything about like the game itself,
yes,
you've seen a robot ninja just flipping around and doing like 60 million backflips as like 80 enemies fire fruitlessly upon them. Soulframe is much slower. You have like axes and staves and bows instead of a hyper futuristic war gear. So it is very interesting to see Digital Extremes take the stuff that really works about Warframe and be like, oh, if you haven't, you know, been around for like 13 years, here's something that's new and fresh and has the stuff that people do like without having the burden of having to catch up on like a decade of lore. And yeah, so right. I've been enjoying Soulframe, because Digital Extremes aesthetics, like they have beautiful environmental artists, sound composers, like the environments in both Soulframe and Warframe are top tier. So it's been really cool to see Soulframe come together.
Do you still play as a robot? Soulframe.
No, you will play as something called an envoy, which is a, you're not a robot. You are a magical person with a sort of magical prosthetic arm that gives you abilities that, you know, allow you to like communicate with the environment and stuff. So you're not like a chosen one, but you're not just Jim either. You are, you know, somewhere in the middle of.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm like, I've played some Warframe. I've played like 10 to 20 hours of Warframe. Because, like, it's something every Destiny person tries on during an off season when things are going weird. And, like, where this is like, Digital Extremes is really, there's something about, like, their art style and their whole vibe that's just like, it doesn't sound bad. It's like off brand, but I don't mean that badly. It's like off brand in the way that, like, Warframe is like supposed to feel like the Matrix, but instead it kind of feels like Equilibrium. Does that make sense? But like Equilibrium is kind of cool. It's like kind of fun. It's kind of neat. And that's like, that's like the Warframe experience to me. It's like, I see what they're going for. And I think they hit like a little bit below under it, but their aesthetic is like really cool. Like some of the weirdness in Soulframe is like striking. Like the enemies look neat. They look like all the villains look like character, like the main character from like Blasphemous or something, like Catholic lore, just like wandering around this area. And like it's all just a little odd in that way that like Warframe is a little odd, I find personally. And so they make a bunch of weird choices. Like the menu is like I've never seen a game do this other than like Fable 3, and it did not work in that game. But like the main menu is like when you pause to like change out your stuff, you like go into a different plane of existence. But in Soulframe, you like hold tab or whatever, and your character like falls backwards through the earth, and then you like wake up in this tent in this like other planar reality, and it loads fast enough that it's actually pretty sick. And then you can like just at any time just nope out of existence. And like poke around to be like, oh, I'm going to see how much I've upgraded my staff recently. Or I'm going to like go look at a bookshelf.
And there's a fudge girl covered in rats who's mean to you.
Oh, I have not met her yet. I've only met my vaguely Leonardo da Vinci cousin who has Mini-Me sitting on his shoulder.
Well, buddy, you have a French girl covered in rats being really mean to you to look forward to.
Hell yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's the shit I'm here for.
I mean, that does sound good. Like, the thing about this game is, like, I expected the, like, weird movement kid stuff from Warframe to be a bigger part of it. Because, like, that's such... The Warframe identity is just, like, sliding around like a neurotypical person snorting Adderall, like, freaking out. Is, like, that's what the identity of that game is for me. And I'm not super into it. But Soulframe is like Lightcast at a slower pace, but like the combat is still really engaging. Even when I didn't have like any, I'm these days I waffle between either big tanky man or mage, and I decided on mage in this one, so I like the way it felt. And even when I had like one spell that had no combat to it, there's something about the feel of the combat engagements that like I kept wanting to go get stuck in fights. And I did like a little dungeon exploration and it was fine, but then I went and fought a bunch of enemies that were way too high level for me and died and like had to fly like a bird back to my body in order to resurrect. It's weird. Like in like World of Warcraft or something. And I just kept going into this combat encounter over and over and over again until I beat this like level 20 boss just like guarding this gate. And there's a lot of, it seems like an open world-ish setting, which I know is mostly different from Warframe, whereas I think Warframe only has like some open world patrol like areas, right? And this one is more like focused on that.
Yeah,
but the
so
world
Warframe
is just really interesting to explore.
So like you mentioned, you know, falling backwards into your camp. That's in Warframe, you have a spaceship called the Arbiter. And from that spaceship, you launch a mission. And the mission is like, here's a bunch of procedurally generated assets that make like you know, we're putting them together to make a fresh mission map for you. And you go and you assassinate a guy. Style. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You assassinate a guy, you like break into some, you solve some puzzles and stealth past some traps to unlock something, etc. And then yeah, there are open world zones of various types where you're meant to explore. And they yeah, they really did take that into Soul Frame in a way that I think works really well. They also took a lot of inspiration from the East Coast of, or the West Coast of Canada. So it's quite gorgeous. You know, you have like those bubbly forests and trees. And it's also the sort of fantasy game where there are talking bears you encounter and what have you. So it has very much a Canadian feel, which is appropriate for a Canadian developer.
Yeah, it's not something like it kind of runs like ass right now, but that it's like pre-alpha still, like it's founder only at the moment. So it's like, you know, we had to like get codes or and the people can like buy in with like high price founder pack stuff. So it's early and it like the people look a little cursed in terms of like the human beings in the game are scary to look at, I find. But I'm interested. I like, there's a lot of stuff that I want to like about Warframe. And I still think there's a reality in my future where I fall deep down the Warframe hole. I can see it in my mind's eye, but I'm not there yet. And there's something about Soul Frame that is like the idea of being able to, I think like Cass said earlier, start fresh on something like this with a studio that has a really storied history of like big, long support for their games that people love. And like, I don't think Warframe and is like obviously successful and does well, and like Tenocon is huge and everything, but it never hit on like the Destiny the way that like Destiny like captured a huge audience. And it feels like Soul Frame is a new entry into their world, and it's something that like, as someone who's interested in live service games, I look at that and go like, this is my moment, maybe I'll jump into this. I have no idea what like the end game looks like. I have no idea what like activities look like. I saw people looking for friends in the chat and being like, I don't know any of the nouns that you're saying yet. Maybe I will. Someday I'll be like, well, of course I would like to go attack the castle of Blork or whatever. But like right now you're just saying gibberish. But it's something that like I want to go back to it. I don't know if I'm going to go back to it now, but like it's the type of thing where if the next time when we do this show 6 months from now, Cast, like Soul Frame's got a big update, I might be like, all right, I'm going to jump into Soul Frame. I could see myself jumping into some Soul Frame. I could see jumping into some stuff, seeing if it runs a little better now. But like, it's like on my radar, and I'm like glad to have it on my radar at this moment. I could see myself playing some over the holiday if I run out of steam on Destiny eventually as well. It's interesting.
So, another game that's getting a new update, Ryan, is Nine Kings is getting a quest mode. Nine Kings is a game that you and I have played, and you and I love.
Nine Kings has gotten the quest mode. It is out.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Tell me about quest mode, because I have not gone back to Nine Kings in a little bit.
Yeah. I, at this point, have 100 hours in Nine Kings. I love this game. So for people Jeff and I talked about this game forever ago on Big Friendly Guide, our project before Rogue, and we wrote a beginner's guide for it, and it was one of the better things that we ended up doing. Like, people really seemed to like it. And that game is very cool. So the idea behind Nine Kings is it's very simple, like, pixel art kind of city builder game, but it's really like an kind of an auto battler. Where you start with like a 9x9 grid and you're putting down buildings and troops and you have like a base, and every turn, which is basically when you run out of cards where you only have two cards left, is a year in your kingdom's life. And most years are just you fight a battle against another king, and then you can draw a card from their deck, which will then allow you to like put one of their buildings on your board, or upgrade one of their troops that you've already placed in their board before, go to war with a new king, or choose a new like passive policy. It's like it follows a lot of the like deck building type of rules that you might find in the past, but it's not a deck builder. It's much more of like a builder, like a city builder type game that that has that like auto battling things. It was around the time we were talking about, what was the other thing we were talking about? That had a similar idea.
The King is Watching. Yep.
Yeah. The King is Watching, I played a little bit, but Nine Kings has really grabbed me as just this delightfully simple seeming, but really deep, like mathematical simulation where your main goal is to like go until the game breaks. Like, sure, you want to beat the main boss that comes at the end of like 33 years. And it's like, hey, 1 year run and you leveled up your king a little bit and got some new perks. Do you want to go start a new one or do you want to keep going? Like, really, you want to keep going and you want to keep going. And then the game is like, if you keep going, the math might get too much. And I have been in places where the game is literally like, I have a pretty good computer where I have had like slimes that multiply multiple times or have like 500 units on a single tile. And then I multiply them like four different times. And then my computer crashes because I have 50,000 units on the battlefield. Like it's an incredible and delightful game that seems really simple on its face, but has so much complexity to it. The quest mode is something that they added, like, I think a week or two ago. And basically what it is like 83, I think, missions that all take place on this, like, kingdom map. Normally, the game is just you load in, you pick one of the nine kings, and then you do a run, and it assigns you three random other kings as your, or two random other kings as your villains, and then you can pick new ones or make peace and war over the course of the match. This is like you choose a quest that is associated with a particular king on this map. And so you start with like the King of Nothing, who's the most basic tutorial king, who's more like fantasy, just like pure fantasy coded. And you'll start with a quest for them, where it might be like, okay, it's as simple as instead of being at a war with two kings at once, you're at war with every king at the same time. And so you have to do a full 33-year match where you're at war with everyone, which means that it's really a lot more difficult to like put a coherent build together because you're not getting the same cards from the same kings, which you need to upgrade your town. Those are pretty boring. But you might get one like the King of Blood on having like a bomber quest where you are not allowed to draw any cards from the King of Blood's deck that aren't bomber units, which are like explosive units that blow themselves up. And so yeah. You start the battlefield with like three souped up max level, like already buffed bomber units. And basically it's like starts you on like year six or seven or something. And it's basically like, go.
Huh.
Beat the level with this pre-built deck and also this condition. And so then you start thinking about like how the game works, and some of them are pretty easy and some of them are very difficult. Like the bomber one's pretty simple. You have to think being like, okay, well, what works great with bombers? Okay, well, there's some other buildings that the King of Blood has, like the Demon Altar, where whenever your allied units die, this Demon Altar gains stat bonus stats to it. So because your units are guaranteed to die every fight because they blow themselves up when the fight first starts and they run into other enemies, you're going to get tons and tons of stacking stats in this Demon Altar. So I'm going to put one down really early. And okay, well, all of these units are centered around a single unit in the middle that's blank. What am I going to put there? Well, obviously I want to put a cemetery, which is another King of Blood card, a building that makes it to where whenever a unit of yours that's adjacent to the cemetery dies, they're resurrected as an imp, as a little imp that does damage. So then you might be like, okay, well, I'm going to use other cards from like the King of Nomads, which you probably haven't played yet because they came out after the time that you played, to like buff up the cemetery. So the cemetery imps, when they get spawned, now have like way more health and deal way more damage than they normally would. And so that becomes the win condition for like that particular quest. But there's a ton of these different ones here. Like, I just played one before we started here because I've been logging in and playing like one or two of them a day to make progress and like obsessing over it for like 2 weeks at this point, where like the entire point was you're playing the King of Progress, which is all about like leveling units up, and you start with four shrines, which are this like very rare building that spends money every year to level up a random card on your field. So you start with four of them, and you start with the special perk that allows every King of Progress specific unit to have no max level. And then you start with a handful of cards. It's basically like solve the puzzle. Go. And there's a bit of RNG to all of these things, so you might find yourself restarting if you get bad luck or something, which is mildly annoying, but I think is way overshadowed by how engaging and rewarding they are, both in terms of like, it has taught me to appreciate, I tend to gravitate towards like three or four of the kings that I spent the most time on that I really like the play style of. But by doing these quests, it has taught me a lot of value that there is in like buildings and kings and units and play styles that I just never touched before. Like the King of Progress is a king that I really didn't like using, but doing stuff like this where all of a sudden you're putting down like, normally the strategy with him is to like put down rats that then level up when an adjacent thing levels up. So you put a bunch of rats around each other, and then every time one rat levels up, they all level up and they have unlimited levels to them. And that's the normal strategy. But because anything on their units can level up, I put down like their exterminator things that like shoot guns at distant targets, and then their big tank unit that reflects damage back. And I just put those two down, and I just let them like infinitely level up off of each other all the time. And like, it forces you to adapt and learn other strategies that have enriched and expanded my knowledge of this game that I already was like, this is one of my favorite things I've played all year. And now it's like, oh, I could very confidently beat high level difficulties with any of these kings using cards that I previously was like, I will never use this. Like what? I'm going to use this one tent ability that the King of Nomads has that like whenever you place down a new target, it buffs up all their stats by 2%. I'm like, that's useless. Except it's not, because I did a quest where it starts with a bunch of these tents and teaches you that every time you move, like the Nomad King is all about moving things from one tile to another. But every time you do that, it triggers the tent. And you see how just 2% stats every time you move something can drastically and exponentially like buff up these cards around you. And so it shows you firsthand, as long as you're willing to like take the lesson, the power of all these things that the dev team have made. And it's just really, normally like I don't like situations like this, like puzzle scenario of this existing game, but this one that is so well done, and it does such a good job of expanding knowledge, and it is not afraid to be very punishing and very hard, that like, man, it has taken something that I was like very certain was in my top five games of the year with Nine Kings, and I'm like, I don't know where it's going to land at this point, but it's like top, as we're all figuring out game of the year stuff right now, it is like anywhere in my top three at any given moment. Nine Kings, I cannot recommend enough. This new quest mode just like really adds a ton of depth to it as well. And its functions as both like tutorial and mastery mode. It's so good. I like cannot recommend this game enough to people. I think it's genuinely like a much easier recommend for people as well, rather than the Bazaar, which is like way complicated from the beginning. Sure. Nine Kings is much more palatable to start with, but that depth is there, and you can really find it in the quest mode. So I would gush about this game for forever. So someone else has to say something.
Nine Kings is one of those games where like I have not checked it out myself, because I just think there has been such a glut of like deck building, card building, roguelikes. I'm still catching up on Slay the Spire, right? So it's the sort of game where I'm really glad you're enjoying it. I just have like such a backlog of like Cultist Simulator, Slay the Spire, Sanatorium. It feels like right now card-based roguelikes are plentiful. So I think that's actually cool that you have become so enamored with Nine Kings, because I mean, there are genres where you'll take whatever you get, because like, it's not like they make a bunch of these, right? Like big narrative RPGs or point and click adventures right now. Exactly.
For a long time.
Like, you certainly get some of those, but I wouldn't call it a deluge. You're not like, how am I going to eat all these pancakes? So for Nine Kings to have seized your attention so is definitely
a
point in its favor.
I definitely, to not to push back because you're not wrong, but I think it's unfortunate that he uses cards at all, because I think really what cards are in this game's case are more of like an easy to understand translation of a building tile that you would find in something more
like a tile.
Against the Storm or something, kind of like my wife is playing through that right now on the Switch. She really likes that game. It's a super fun roguelike city builder game. Very cool. But it uses them as like an easily, because card stuff and card deck builders are so everywhere, I think in an effort to make itself digestible, which I do think helps make it digestible, to be clear, in a way Nine Kings makes it really difficult to sell itself, because you have to be like, well, it's a card-based deck builder. And people are like, no, I'm fully good. I'm out. And you're like, no. But they're buildings instead. Is that helpful? And it's like, I think it's just trying to be digestible. It does not quite, it's not in the same, I would not put it in the same genre as like a Slay the Spire, like Monster Train 2 is something I really want to get into. That's very much a Slay the Spire, like deck building card game. Nine Kings, I think, I mean, Jeff, you don't think I'm underselling the card aspect of it, right? I think it's more of like an ease of use translation rather than I don't think it fully functions like a card thing, just for anybody who might hear those words and be like, gross.
Right.
Give it a try or take a look at it. I think it's a little bit different.
No, it's really a lot more. It's a like base building auto battler. Like the buildings that you put in function a lot more like the buildings that you put in Civilization 7. Like they each come with their own passive effects that just stack up over time. And yeah, like you said, it's not specifically about the cards. It's about the effects that you're picking.
Yeah, and they're specifically like, other than a few very limited limited opportunities, like the King of Nomads, like once you put something down, like it's down. Like you can't move it. In much more of a like, unless you use something to like delete it or destroy it, like you need a separate card for it. Much more akin to a city builder than where there's like punishment for putting something down, rather than like a something like the Bazaar, where you're putting down an item and then you're moving it around the area all the time. So yeah, it's like it's technically in that genre, but I think it's a little bit different than that. But also like hard to explain without just using the word card, which is probably why they look like cards in the game, is because it's just an easily digestible thing. But yeah, I mean but either way, to your point, Cass, you're absolutely right. Like there is no shortage of these games. So whenever one comes along that's really special, it's like, it's such a delight to be taken by them and be like, right, yes, these games aren't all just like, this is a pretty good one of those. It's like, no, this is like, to me, Nine Kings is just like genre defining. I put it way up there for me, and I love it. Not to have to follow that up, Jeff, but like Nine Kings is a bit of an auto battler, and you've also played a bit of an auto battler recently with Xenopurge, which I read about you from. It sounds interesting.
Xenopurge is, it's kind of not an auto battler. Because what Xenopurge is you are the guy with a cup of coffee and a cigarette sitting at the computer desk while everybody else goes off and fights, and you just watch their little blips run around on your map. All you really have control of is giving them orders about like priority. Like you tell them, hey, it's time to leave, or go pick up that box, or like, you know, escort the VIP. You can only control the logic of what they do when they spot an enemy. Like, one guy just charges at them until he can engage in melee, but you can upgrade him to run and gun so that he shoots the whole time that he's running up to them. And yeah, it was like, it's a relatively small game that I have not gotten out of the first area yet. But just a really cool and clever, like, you don't actually see much. All of the good guys and bad guys are just little blips on the screen. And yet it manages to be super tense and just fraught gameplay because you're screaming at your little dots to survive or turn left instead. And that's not anything you can control.
No, that's definitely cool because you mentioned, like, you're not just straight up directing people like an RTS. Instead, you're encouraging them. And that reminds me a lot of, like, RimWorld or Dwarf Fortress, where there's, like, a certain amount of agency. Like, in RimWorld, I can tell someone, like, don't go here, don't do this, you're just working hard. But they can, like, decide on their own, depending on the pawn and the circumstances of what's going on. They can still choose, like, bust into the liquor cabinet or cause problems, right? And I like that tension. I think it's always a really fun bit of tension, and it goes across all genres. When you are not in total control as the player, like, these are not mindless automatons where you're punching in every order, but they have their own agenda, and you're just encouraging them. Maybe they do what they want, you know? And I think that leads to some really fun moments.
Mm-hmm.
Especially with, like, what you're mentioning, that you're, like, kind of playing mission control. So I can imagine you're, like, setting up a perfect plan, and they go off. They go off course, and you're like,
what are you doing?
Perfect.
It's really funny when, like, you have to be very careful about who is leading the group, because if the wrong person is, then, like, your support team will just sprint off after an alien they saw and leave everybody else behind who are just trying to get out of there. And you're like, no, come back! But you have no control over what they do. And they lean into the, like, aliens aesthetic a lot. So everything you do, you play on the keyboard. Like, you don't even click. You just hear, like, big mechanical keyboard ka-chunks while you're hitting just a few keys.
Are these little guys procedurally generated, like a RimWorld or a State of Decay 2? Or is it, like, a roster you're picking from?
I think they are vaguely procedurally generated. You usually start with the first two that seem to be set, and then everybody else seems kind of random. I would like to see some more randomness and procedural generation, especially in, like, the dialogue, because the dialogue is just a bunch of canned lines that don't necessarily reflect reality.
All right, sorry about that, everybody. We had a brief technical hiccup here, but Jeff, you were talking about Xenopurge.
Okay. Yeah, and as you play Xenopurge, you can, like, buy everybody new guns, and, like, the guns unlock cool new, like, ranged attacks and change how everybody behaves. Yeah. Really cool game. I was really surprised by it. Like, because I went into
rad.
It.
I was really enjoying reading your preview.
Yeah, no, I went into it expecting
an RTS. And it's not an RTS. Like, it really is just that scene from all of those movies. You know, like that trope that I can't quite put my finger on.
It feels very, like, aliens
walls.
Coded.
Yes, exactly. Exactly that.
Yeah, no. Speaking of shooting aliens with Big Gun, the beloved pastime of all gamers. So Helldivers 2 has been, Helldivers 2 as a game, we've discussed this before, has kind of a trend of it's over and then we're so back. And I think we might be coming up on the we're so back with the new War Bonds. So War Bonds are essentially they're like little DLC packs. You can get them for free through dedicated playing. I generally just dish out the $10 every 3 months or whatever. Because I like Helldivers. And you get a pack of new cosmetics and guns and weapons and so on and so forth. And so there is a war bond called Viper Commandos that was very popular. It was like berets, jungle camouflage, chemicals that like hit harder and really stim you up. Now we are getting on December 2nd, the Python Commandos. So this is the first time they've really done like a sequel war bond, but people are quite happy with it. And I'm going to say there are two things that really sell this one. The first is the defoliation tool, which is a really great bit of storytelling. This is the Warhammer 40K fucking chainsword. And on Super Earth, they're using that stuff on their hedges. And I guess they decided, why not ship it off to the war front? So we're getting a sword, which I am totally fine with. But perhaps more tantalizing is we are finally getting a fucking maxi gun. Like, there are heavy machine guns and, like, you know, there's firepower. But this is straight up, you know, the sort of action movie machine gun with a loaded backpack that players have wanted for a long time. And like Helldivers 2 fans, they complain a lot, you know, they don't like this, they don't like that. But give them a minigun, give them a backpack with a drone that shoots fire, and they're happy. Oh, yeah. I'm happy. So I'm very much looking forward to this particular war bond. Especially because we're in a part of the story where we're very much sort of building up to things. Like there are ups and downs. There are storylines that unfold over time. And we're kind of in a little bit of a low period while Arrowhead adjust and repair and patch the problems introduced by the Into the Unjust update. But this Python Commandos is like, for me, that's the incentive I need to jump back in for a couple of weeks and see what's going on in the war front.
Yeah. Helldivers 2 is another one that I never, like, I missed getting into it, but I love reading everything you write about it because everything about that game seems awesome. I can't believe that there wasn't a, like, mini chain gun in that game already.
Yeah.
That's something else is when the game started, we were fighting on barren planets with like a relatively limited arsenal. And the Arrowhead has done a really good job of scaling things up with the mega cities on Super Earth. So like, you know, massive urban environments, vehicles, new weapons. So these goodies are very much well enjoyed, and it's interesting to see how they trickle out. You know, like one tool that really changed the way people play for good and for ill is there's a powerful item called the Hell Bomb that you could only call in when like a mission called for it. Like you would run up to the objective and it would go, you can call in a Hell Bomb, and you'd be like, great. And then in a war bomb, they added something called the portable hell bomb, which you carry around on your back and you can trigger it at literally any time. And I love to do that because I have one friend in particular who he hears the activation noise and he starts screaming. He goes, where is it? Where is it? And I'm jogging lightly behind him and he doesn't like it and nobody laughs. But I enjoy it quite a bit. So really, really, I think that's what matters, right? So
absolutely.
Kind of need to get back into Helldivers. We all need to, like, I think we had talked about, like, for a December stream when things sort of chill out a little bit that we might have to get Jeff and I back into Helldivers. Or Jeff, did you ever play it?
No, I never touched it.
Man, okay, yeah. I have got about like 6 or 7 hours in it probably, but I would like to play with like a full squad. That game's fun. I'm eager to check in on it. Yes, yeah, like very barren planets, not in a bad way, is definitely my recollection of it. So to hear that like it's a lot more diverse and wild in terms of like what's going on is exciting.
Oh yeah. Yeah, you have cities, you have like factory, big automaton factories, you have terminated worlds that are overgrown and like covered in chitin and biological mass. It's all very cool. So maybe this week I will be in the game a lot. So if you ever want a tour guide, I will be happy to show you the ropes.
Indeed.
Yep. For sure. Look for that on the website at some point in the next. We like two weeks ago, I think at this point, we went and streamed Arby There Yet.
Yep.
And Peak, which was a lot of fun. So hopefully we'll be back and with some Helldivers this month. But Jeff, you have one more thing to talk about, which is like,
I do.
Not what I thought it would be based on the name of it, but it's called Puzzle Parasite, and it's like Portal.
It is, yeah. And that's kind of what made me pick up the game, or request the code. Thanks for the code. Request the code was, it's inspired by Portal. Like, and it wears that on its sleeve. Like, it's a problem for any first-person puzzler is that Portal is already out and Portal is already perfect. So it's going to be really hard to make a first-person puzzler stand out, let alone compete. But yeah, Puzzle Parasite is, you're an astronaut dude dropped on a planet all by yourself, and you are equipped with a cricket bat and nothing else, and then you wander around touching alien artifacts and picking up new powers. And the extent of the game, it is 76 puzzles long. The extent of the game is hitting glowing alien orbs into receptacles, and that solves the puzzle and moves you to the next puzzle room. And it knows exactly what it is. It doesn't overstay its welcome. Like, each of the five kinds of orbs have different properties. Like, one of them phases through the bat, so you can only carry it around. One of them explodes anytime you pick it up, so you can only hit it or pull it. One of them, what was the other one? Another one you can't, like, pull with your telekinesis. And it's just really cool, really straightforward first-person puzzling. Like, a little bit physics-based with the whacking glowing orbs with your cricket bat. But I've said this before, and I think I said it in my review that will be up by the time this releases, is the only thing missing is that, like, super cool, now you're thinking with Portal's aha moment. Like, there's that, it's 4 or 5 puzzles into Portal where, like, your brain fully breaks and then reconnects. And there's not that physics breaking in Puzzle Parasite. There's just puzzle, like, physics puzzles. There's a little bit of lateral thinking, like, you kind of have to get a little clever, but it's a really satisfying little first-person puzzle. And it's got a cool, like, instead of GLaDOS, you've got two people back on your ship who are trying to rescue you, delivering dialogue in each room. And it's got a really cool little story going on in the background that cranks up the crypt factor of it. So yeah, really cool.
I feel like
pretty cheap game too. Like, I think it's $10.
Yeah, I feel like I'm due for one of those, like a first person puzzler. Like, sounds delightful to me in a way that it hasn't in quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
Especially since, like, God knows we're not getting Portal 3 ever.
But, yeah, right.
Yeah, that sounds cute.
Mm-hmm. It was a lot of fun. What's your last
game? I got one more thing.
I have not heard of your last game.
I had not heard of it either. And I got a code emailed to me, which happens. Thanks, Indies, for sending your codes in. To make it easier for us to check stuff out when there's a billion things out there. So I decided to check this out. And because it's like seemed similar-ish to something like The Bazaar, which is one of my big things this year that really, really, really hit for me. So CrossBlitz is initially, there seems to be like two primary game modes to it. And it is a card-based deck building game. But it's the initial mode was more like a Slay the Spire type of situation. Like, it's actually the secondary mode on the listing, but I ended up picking it and going through, and it's like this large map of this area that you're climbing and you're fighting like an enemy there, and it's basically like you're playing what is essentially like a Hearthstone map that has some like two lanes that sit on top of each other and cards that function very similarly to Hearthstone with mana and everything operating on it. And it just didn't really click for me. I wasn't really enjoying it. It was kind of the situation where I'm like, I'm checking this out to talk about it on the podcast, and I narrowly survived an encounter and was like, damn. I was kind of hoping I was going to go out on that one. And it just was not really clicking for me at all. It was very, it's very much that moving through Slay the Spire, building up your deck type of situation, the same way as like I've played in a lot of other games like this. And so I was not like going into the other mode with super high hopes. But the other mode is a lot more interesting, to the point where like I was playing and I was enjoying it enough that like I saved my game and I'm like, maybe I'll come back to this. Basically, how it works is instead of a like ever expanding deck where you're going through a map, Slay the Spire style, it's more of like an overworld map where you're kind of walking along like a bunch of like hexagons in different on like a grid, and you pick like a hero type character that has a skill tree, and you start with like a certain amount of cards. So I picked like a pirate character. They're like a lion character that uses a bunch of pirate cards. And you start in this hex map and you can go and like, oh, there's an event over here where you can like meld cards together, use like crafting materials or whatever to make new cards. And then you can go and level up your, you know, complete a battle over in this area, and that unlocks a different area, a different outlet that you can then leave to move around this like square grid, and each square on the grid is its own little world, hexagonal world island, with increasingly difficult enemies and bosses, but also like stores and other things. And you're spending gold that you're earning, or spending money that you're earning in battles on these cards for both artifacts, which are like passive things that constantly exist. And basically I ended up building into something because there's a maximum capacity of cards in your deck in this one mode. And so you're only able to do so much. You have to really lean into something specific with the cards that you end up getting, rather than in the other mode where you're just kind of like compiling a bunch of stuff together and you have to filter cards out if you don't want them. Like, you have to go to a special event to do it. In this, it's a lot more like you are collecting cards as you're going through, as you're leveling up, and then you're building something helpful. So I ended up building like a cannon-based deck where I would throw down expensive cannon that didn't do anything, but every time I put down a new pirate enemy, it would fire off a cannon shot that did damage from another target on the board. And you have to eliminate, like, targets can block the health bar of enemies, so you have to eliminate targets. So it's an important thing to do. Or then you can drop down, I then got, like, another card that allowed me to, like, that had this contextual ability on it that every time I start combat, which is once I'm done putting my cards down, it fires off all cannons. So suddenly, like, it becomes a cannon build, and now my cannons can target the enemy health bar as well if there's no enemies out there. So suddenly it becomes like you're building into this identity through the skill tree as you're moving around these islands and battles. And it's really is kind of just a restructuring of the game from the version of it that I didn't like. But there's enough stuff in this different mode that, like, it's an interesting look in terms of, like, how small systematic differences and decisions can make such a huge difference, even if the core game is solid. Because I found this, like, hexagonal version of it so much more palatable and enjoyable and, like, well-paced, and, like, it wasn't just, like, battle event where I'm, like, picking 1,000 cards to add to my deck. Is very overwhelming and hard to enjoy in this other mode. And it gave me an idea that, like, I could go into this, spend some time in this other mode, play it for a while, and then maybe I would enjoy the other one better when I have a better understanding of the game. But it's really, like, shocked me to jump between the two of them and see how much more I liked it on this other mode. Now, I haven't gone back to it, to be clear. Like, I have a bunch of other stuff that I'm really enjoying and playing right now, and so, like, it is, like, struggling to fully capture my attention in that way. But I definitely saved it with the intention that, like, I might go back and try this out, and I really think I might hear during some time in the winter. It's cute. The art style is really cute, like the pixely aspect of it, and, like, the cards seem interesting, but it really was that secondary mode that kind of reframed it in a way that was a little bit different than 1,000 different things that I played before. That yeah, kind of right. Helped sell me on what it's doing.
Yeah, it's interesting how many games, like, there are these huge components that work or are well-designed. There's just, like, some element of how they're brought together or connected that just can, like, disconnect with your personal taste. Like, a lot of the games I play, I'm like, the developer did not necessarily do something wrong. This just isn't for me. And I always think it's cool whenever something that's not for me, that's otherwise well-made, you know, can be enjoyed due to a new update or a patch or just something that kind of shifts the balance there a little bit more.
Yeah, for sure. It's definitely, like, it is truly one of the weirdest, like, flip-flops I've had on something like this in a really long time of, like, oh, I'm going to not be particularly excited to talk about this on the show, to being like, oh no, there's something here. I don't know if it's something for me, but the inherent value is, like, this isn't just Hearthstone but Slay the Spire. It's a lot deeper than that and a lot more compelling. So, like, nice to see. I was initially, like, pretty bummed by what seemed like bland at first. So it's, I don't know, always play both modes, I guess, if you're playing something like this. Like, you never know what thing you're going to run into. Apparently it's been in, like, early access for a while. I just hadn't seen it. But it's got, like, it's well reviewed on Steam and everything. So people who are playing it seem to be enjoying it, and it looks like it hit early access in, like, 2023. I just haven't heard it before. So, yeah. The story campaign is cool.
I've got nothing on this one.
Yeah. I hadn't heard anything of it, but, like, one of the cooler things about what we are trying to do here is, like, covering stuff like this. And so, like, I get sent a lot of codes and stuff, and so sometimes it's hard to accept everything and take time when there's, like, not that many of us here to spread stuff around and play things. So sometimes a lot of stuff gets missed. So apologies if you sent me an email and I haven't responded to you. But something I enjoy and I think is really helpful about this show, and that I like using this show for, is, like, spending a little bit of time on something like Four Strike that we talked about last time that I didn't necessarily think would be for me, or like Cross Blitz this time. and coming in and being like, well, what is this actually? I can play it for an hour. And then suddenly something that none of us have heard of is now like on some radars. Like, I'm not sure if I would have played Nine Kings initially if we hadn't gotten like an email or something back around when we were doing Big Friendly Guide. And it like blew up for me. And now it's in the running for like my game of the year. So that's, absolutely. You know, it's really hard to cover stuff like Cross Blitz. And even stuff like Nine Kings, which I mean, Nine Kings has a lot more reviews than CrossFit does on Steam. So more well-known, I think. But it's really hard to cover some of that stuff when you're at Polygon or a site of that size. Not Polygon specifically, but that's our experience. There's so much stuff and internal pressure on like what you need to get done in a given week in terms of like your beats and the stuff that you usually cover that it can be really tough to sell. Like, hey, I found this game. I got sent this email. This looked kind of neat. You need a really solid angle to sell that as like a good pitch for a big site like that. So hopefully that's something that we are doing here, that we are continuing to doing. That's something I really wanted to do from the beginning, was be able to highlight more of these things more easily, because the lifts to just like write something up about it or jump on here to chat about it is a lot less. So CrossBlitz. Check it out. See if it's for you. Xenopurge also is something that I hadn't heard of and is undelighted by. So, check this kind of stuff out. I mean, usually we're all just like jump on the Steam. It's like, I find just jumping on when someone's talking about stuff that sounds mildly interesting and just looking at screenshots immediately tells me whether it's actually something I would be interested in or not. And more often than not, I find that like, oh, this is cooler than I anticipated. So, about to close out here, I think. But like, we were going to talk very briefly about our plans for Game of the Year. If you are curious, we've done away, like we were just talking about, we've done away with a lot of the stuff that we used to do, like big industry things that we don't really want to have to do anymore. But we did want to do the self-congratulatory, self-important game awards for our website. Because now we can, and it's all up to us this time. So that's not going anywhere. We're still doing that. If you want to read about our plans, there's a whole thing on the site, either right now as you're reading this or as you're listening to this, or within the next day or two, before the weekend, to be sure. There will be something both talking about our nominees, which are basically just games that we liked this year. And also, like, what all we'll be doing. But generally speaking, Jeff, do you want to hit up, like, what our kind of idea is here? What's going to look like?
The rough plan is starting in about a week and a half, I think, from when this goes up. We're going to put out a category, like, best indie, best AAA game, best action game, etc., with a list of nominees and blurbs. There'll be an article on the site. And then we are going to put up an audience poll as well for everybody to participate in. And then the following week, we will announce both our choice for each of those categories and the audience choice for each of those categories. So you'll get a chance to vote in all 10 categories that we have. And we're also going to do some more off-color, tongue-in-cheek categories and like super individual categories for each of us here at Rogue. So there'll be a bunch of articles, at least 20 articles, over the last couple of weeks of the year, leading up to our Game of the Year announcement on January 2nd, I think is what we settled on for release of that.
Yeah, and this serves a couple different functions. Mostly it's the self-important award thing, but also it gives us kind of an opportunity. We've been working hard on the site for couple of months now, and it gives us a chance to spend to do some work ahead of time and to schedule things out. So the last 2 weeks of the year, just as a heads up, 2 weeks from now, we'll have our last regularly scheduled podcast of the year, and then we'll have two small summary podcasts about Game of the Year stuff in early January and very, very late 2025. Then for like the last 2 weeks, both like the first week of January and the last week with Christmas, we are going to be taking that time more or less off to kind of relax, spend time with our families and stuff like that. So stuff will still be going up on the site. That's when the Game Awards, the Game of the Year Award articles will be hitting. But those will be pre-written and done. So we were going to take some time to relax and be with our families before coming in and doing our first full year as a website of 2026. Yeah. We got some fun stuff planned in just in even the opening months coming up. There's already like some great games coming. So it's going to be a good year, but we wanted to rest a little bit after what's been a hard year for all of us. With 2025, it's also, you know, brought something great that we all enjoy spending a lot of time with and are very deeply appreciative of everyone listening, which is how I will also transition into the usual goodbye spiel, which is that we couldn't do this without any of you because we are completely user and reader supported website. We have no ads. We're never going to have ads. It's all you all. And you can get everything that we ever do for just $7 a month or $70 a year. We have higher subscription tiers from that if you'd like to support us. They come with some additional benefits, but everything that gets like paywalled, $7 a month is all you need. And we're building up our users and so grateful to all of you who are already here. And grateful to those of you who will be here in the near future as well. So thank you all very much for listening. Does anybody have anything else before we close it out today as we're kind of getting out of here quick and dirty on the back of Game of the Year stuff?
No, I think that's everything.
All right. Well, again, we wouldn't exist without your support. So thank you all again. Tell your friends, share us around if you'd like, show the podcast to someone else. We really appreciate it. And we'll be back again for the last regularly scheduled podcast of the year on December 17th. And until then, bye. Thanks for listening.
Bye-bye.
Bye.